This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 5th of August 2016. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 5th of August 2016. Which this week have been edited by Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. Your readers today are John Regan.
Hello there.
Maria Head.
Hello.
And Paul Maxlow Tomlinson.
Hello everyone.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. Now the main headlines this week: Closure Order Fury, Armed Jewel Gang Get 32 Years, and Radio Station Given License. So, John, may we have the story behind the first headline, please?
Yes, Closure Order Fury. Winchester civic chiefs have come under fire after securing a closure order at a disorderly city centre house. Magistrates approved the closure order for the property at 16 Water Lane after more than 5 years of worsening nuisance and antisocial behaviour. But neighbours are unhappy that it took so long. One said, "The council did not take it seriously until we told them we were going to take them to court. They've been pathetic and did nothing for years. It's as if all the rights are with the tenants. It's strange how the law protects them. I don't feel they deserve any support. They're a waste of time." The City Council did not respond to requests for a comment on the allegation before the Chronicle went to press. An order's been placed on the terraced property banning anyone from entering the property for the next 3 months. The order names the two residents as the tenant, Valerie Smith, and habitual occupant, James Green. The court found that in relation to the address, people had engaged in disorderly, offensive and criminal behaviour, causing a serious nuisance to neighbours. The property will be boarded up for 3 months, while the council undertakes proceedings to regain possession of the property, which is mandatory. Residents in Water Lane spoke of their relief following the closure of the house, but many did not want to be named due to fear of reprisals. One resident said, "Thank goodness they've gone. It was a bit of a nightmare, and it's not just our street affected, it was the street behind us too." Councillor Caroline Horrell, the portfolio holder for housing, said in a statement, "This firm action is a last resort, and such powers are used rarely, but it shows clearly that the council will not tolerate antisocial behaviour in its properties. The closure option for disorderly property has been enforced since the advent of the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act of 2014, and this is the first case that the council has brought using these powers." The court heard that 9 local residents complained and completed impact statements, while complaints were received from at least 5 more residents and the local business, the pub, number 5 Bridge Street. The council has continued to receive complaints, escalating in severity, including alcohol abuse and alleged drug dealing from the property, aggressive behaviour, fighting in the street and foul and abusive language, bonfires and the deliberate setting alight of a sofa in the back garden resulting in toxic fumes. And despite numerous visits and warning letters to Miss Smith regarding the conduct of her tenancy, all of these warnings have been ignored. The most recent problems emerged in April, and the council took the view that the only solution was to close the property.
Armed Jewel Gang Get 32 Years. It was one of the biggest armed robberies ever in Winchester. A normal Friday morning descended into chaos last April, when 3 armed robbers carried out a terrifying raid on Justice Jewellers in Parchment Street. But their plans were thwarted thanks to the quick thinking of Winchester residents and a rapid police response. Now the men are behind bars for a combined total of 32 years. David George, 21, of Furze and Crescent, Hatfield; Domingo Nasita, 29, of Windsor Crescent, London; and Joshua Tiloye, 22, of Featherstone Close, Stevenage, all pleaded guilty to one count of armed robbery and another of possessing an imitation firearm with intent to cause fear of violence. At Winchester Crown Court, Taloyi and George were sentenced by the Recorder of Winchester, Judge Keith Cutler, to 10 years each and Nisita to 12 years. The court heard how it was described as a commercially planned armed robbery. During the robbery on April the 15th, an imitation firearm was held to the head of owner of Justice, John Quayle. In less than 6 minutes, more than £200,000 worth of watches and jewellery were stolen. The goods were later recovered when the trio were arrested. George and Taloyi wore black motorcycle helmets and disguises. The pair jumped out of a Peugeot van driven by Nisita. Taloyi was in possession of a green BB gun. He manhandled Mr. Quayle and threatened to kill him. Taloyi told him, "Do not move or I will kill you." Little did the trio know that the police were already alerted by staff at Winchester Travel Service, who saw the robbers run into Justice. Nisita had originally parked outside Justice, but after a member of the public asked for it to be moved, he parked further down Parchment Street. Nisita was arrested after a police vehicle blocked the van from one side and a dustbin lorry had inadvertently blocked it from the other, leaving him without an escape route. The court heard as Nisita was arrested, he told officers, "I ain't done nothing." George and Taloyi were seen running out of the store and were quickly arrested as members of the public directed police to where they were hiding. Police seized a gas-powered BB gun and a hammer, as well as face masks and all of the jewellery. The court heard how Nisita was on licence from prison and had 23 previous convictions. Taloyi and George were of previous good character and were former university students. All three have written to Mr. Quayle expressing remorse. DC Darren Carey said, "Thanks to the swift actions of the officers, these three dangerous men have been taken off the streets of Hampshire. Within minutes of this raid starting, our officers were on scene, ready to confront whatever they were faced with to protect the public. Despite information that these men had firearms, our teams did not hesitate to carry out their duty. Our units had contained the scene and blocked off any escape route, giving the offenders no chance of a getaway. This was a great example of local neighbourhood officers working alongside specialist teams from the Hampshire and Thames Valley Joint Operations Unit to bring swift justice to criminals. I also want to pay tribute to the brave members of the public who remained at the scene to assist officers by providing vital information about where the suspects had fled to. Their assistance ensured we found these men as quickly as possible, preventing further harm to the public. We hope this sends a strong message to our communities that we will take robust action against those who think they can come to Hampshire to commit crimes." And there's a photo with this article of John Quayle outside Justice in Parchment Street after the raid, in which a gun was held to his head.
The headline, "Radio Station Given License," sits above a picture of eight smiling staff of Winchester Radio celebrating the granting of a new FM community license. Winchester Hospital Radio could soon be ruling the airwaves in the city. Winchester Radio has been awarded a community radio license by the Ofcom regulator. Currently, the volunteer-led station, which is based at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, only plays for patients for 4 hours a day. But with a license, people within a 5 kilometre radius will be able to pick up the station on an FM frequency from 2018 onwards. The station, which is a charity, will now be organising planning permission for various equipment like a transmitter and put a management structure in place to cope with the change. The history of the service dates back to 1968. Trustee of the charity, Nigel Dallard, 51, from Badger Farm, has been involved with Winchester Radio since 1987. Mr. Dallard said, "It feels fantastic." Chairman of Winchester Radio, Anna O'Brien, said, "I'd like to express my thanks to my fellow trustees of Winchester Radio for all their time, research and hard work in putting the business case together for the community radio bid, and the rest of our wonderful volunteers for their enthusiasm."
And I should add on the end of that that, of course, we were closely associated with Winchester Hospital Radio when our studio was based in the hospital, and Nigel and Anna were very helpful in setting up our new digital studio down here at Steeles. And that concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, then Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, historical items, chronicle comment, first person and Belgarum. So we'll start with the death announcements. Baisley, Simon Henry Baisley, died on the 29th of July, aged 62. Burton, Sheila Ann Burton, passed away on the 21st of July, aged 77. Cleaver, Marjorie Cleaver, MBE, died peacefully at home on the 28th of June, aged 92. Dalton, Joan Lillian Dalton, aged 87, died on the 20th of January. I'm sorry, on the 16th of July. Greg, Chris Gregg, passed away unexpectedly at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 79. Rowles, Mary Doris Rowles, passed away suddenly but peacefully on the 22nd of July, aged 93. And Ventham, Beverly Joy Ventham, passed away unexpectedly on the 25th of July, 2016. Now we move on to Christian comment, please, Paul.
Christian comment has the headline, "The Danse Macabre in Normandy." In the Danse Macabre, skeletons lead the living into the arms of death. These carvings and paintings were popular during the plague when death randomly took mortals by the hand for the dance. There's an interpretation of this at Rouen, dating from the Black Death, which claimed three-quarters of the population. There are carvings of skulls and mortality is further recalled by a mummified cat. Death's random nature, as seen in macabre art. Sanctioned religious death is also recalled in Rouen, the place where Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake for heresy. Last week, Rouen horrifically experienced the Danse Macabre complete with religious motivation. Father Jacques Hamel was murdered while celebrating Mass in the city's edge. The murder of priests at the altar is nothing new. In Canterbury, Thomas a Becket was killed by three knights who heard Henry II say, "Who will rid me of this troublesome priest?" They then took it upon themselves to do the ridding. More recently, the Archbishop in El Salvador, Oscar Romero, was shot after standing up for the poor and marginalised. Pope Francis called Father Jacques' murder absurd. And all acts of violence are ultimately absurd. His killing was a desperate act which makes no sense. That Father Jacques' death occurred while celebrating Mass gives a context to his priesthood. The Mass, or Eucharist, or Holy Communion, is a representation of Jesus' crucifixion. John Paul II said in the Mass, "Jesus left us a means of sharing in it as if we had been present there." Just as, for the Jews, the celebration of the Passover transports those celebrating back to the first Passover and Israel being led out of slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land. So the Mass, based on a Passover meal, transports those present to the upper room and the sacrifice of Calvary. When Father Jacques recall the words of Jesus, "This is my body, this is my blood." They are present in a sense that goes beyond memory. Christians celebrate the Mass because it's a representation of the sacrifice of the one person who's both sinless and supremely good, the ultimate victim of injustice. This sacrifice fulfills all sacrifice and declares acts of violence absurd. Before Jesus, the Israelites offered animal sacrifice, an example being the scapegoat, where the sins of the people were prayed over a goat who was then driven into the wilderness, symbolically carrying the sins of the people out of the community. However, animal blood's not perfect and had to be offered again and again. Jesus, being truly good and truly innocent, is offered only once and carries the sins of all, so we no longer need to be weighed down by sin. The Mass isn't a danse macabre, but recalls a sacrifice freely given by the one who is truly good and truly innocent, shaming all acts of violence and prejudice. Father Jacques Bishop said, "The Church can take up no weapons other than those of prayer and the brotherhood among people of goodwill." And that was written by Father Paul Kennedy, who's the rector of the East Winchester Benefice. The Danse Macabre is a piece of music written by Saint-Saëns.
Thank you, Paul. Now we move on to letters to the editor. John.
Yes, here's a letter from Shafiul Hussain, who's chairman of the Winchester Muslim Cultural Association. And Shafiul heads his letter, "Mosque Dismay." The Winchester Muslim Cultural Association, the WMCA, was saddened by the article in last week's Chronicle suggesting we demanded a mosque in this great city. This story about the planning inspector's examination of the local plan did not convey the true spirit and content of our submission, and we'd very much like to put the record straight by making it clear we asked for a multicultural centre to be located in Winchester for use by many faiths, including our own. This most certainly was not a demand, and we're saddened that the article concentrated on the Muslim faith when we mentioned many others in our submission to the inspector for a multi-purpose, multicultural building within the designated development sites. In fact, everything the WMCA and Pir Jadu Qureshi said in the meeting was based and quoted from the National Planning Policy Framework and applied to communities generally and minority ethnic communities especially. We would very much like to say that the WMCA was being reasonable and collaborative in communicating identified community needs, and we offered five options, not demands, for the inspector to consider. But sadly, these were not published in your article. Following the report, we were dismayed to hear from some of our friends in Winchester, who know us to be inclusive, outgoing and good neighbours within the community, and expressing concern that the article appeared to present a picture which they believe is not wholly representative of our work. We've had to assure them that this is not the case, and it's very unfortunate when the truth is quite the opposite. We only wish to be balanced, respectful and measured in our aims and want to work with everyone in the city, including the City Council, to find a cultural centre that will be for many faiths and an asset to the city. For anyone who wishes, our written submission and annex can be found on the Winchester City Council website.
And the subject of Catherine Ternesi's letter is "Businesses Leave City." "Sir, I need to share Winchester BID Board's sheer disappointment and frustration on the outcome of the Station Approach project and what is yet another blow to the business community and their confidence in Winchester City Council. 19 councillors opposed moving forward with a process that allowed for further engagement and the vital development of a design, not a fully blown scheme, which was solving a major issue of growth restriction for current employers in the city. We are in real danger of losing some internationally renowned businesses, many of whom have invested in this community and developing local talent for decades. These businesses need premises to expand, and without this development, there is little alternative but for them to leave the city. I often hear a very limited view along the lines of Winchester will survive no matter what. The current view of many businesses is that there is only so much that one city can take. No Silver Hill, no station approach, a loss of 500-odd parking spaces. Many of our members wonder how much more they can accept before they have to turn elsewhere. Monsoon and childhood's dreams are the latest casualties. Is it any wonder we're losing these brands to other regional locations who are significantly investing in infrastructure, jobs and homes? Winchester has some of the highest commercial rents outside of London and will continue to do so until a plan is resurrected for Silver Hill, which should, in our eyes, still provide prime retail space and thus open up competition to reduce rates and rent. I also often hear people say, we do not need more space because we have vacancies. But the underlying issue is that we don't have enough options for retailers to consider. And now we don't have any options for the commercial sector to consider either. We do believe that leadership and courage are needed, and fast. The council must work together to find a way forward quickly. If not, the council will be responsible for the beginning of what may be the economic decline of this vibrant city. It is always surprising how quickly business communities can decline. Experience elsewhere in the country suggests that a downward spiral can rapidly develop, with vacancy rates entering the teens and then over 20%. Office staff departing and retail declining as they depart, and the normal interaction of high-quality service professions, the restaurant businesses and retail going into reverse. At least the BID wouldn't have to continue to fight to keep parking spaces. There won't be any need for them with few businesses left to visit. Catherine Turness, MIPM, Executive Director, Winchester, BID.
The Alsford and Itchen councillor, Kim Gottlieb, also writes a letter. Sir, I voted against station approach because the process the City Council was pursuing lacked integrity and was never going to end in a successful development. Given that the financial advice it received was that the scheme wasn't viable and that no developer would take it on, the council's confidence that a government grant could justify it tackling an 80 million development itself was naive, to say the least. Even in the best of times, developing Grade A office space in provincial locations is difficult and marginal, however much it might be considered desirable. To have stood any chance of making it happen, the council needed to know exactly what it was doing and to have a full copper-bottom strategy. But very clearly, it didn't. It ignored its own risk register, which described the withdrawal of shortlisted architects as having a major impact. It ignored the development brief in terms of both scale and particularly affordable housing, i.e. there was none. It produced no evidence-based research on potential demand or draft heads of terms with committed tenants ready to sign pre-let agreements. It quite purposely ignored all public comment about either of the two schemes presented. The council also ignored the recommendation of the design jury, specifically established to judge the design. Because the jury's view didn't follow the script, another architect was employed to tell a different and much more positive story about Scheme B and to refer to it as a concept. This was a blatant fudge. The council then found itself in the ludicrous position of having to ask lawyers if the scheme could be changed in any material way later on. The lawyers said no. Even more ludicrous was the legal agreement imposed upon members of the design jury, which barred them from speaking to anyone and had the potential to bankrupt them if they did. The council has a duty of care towards councillors and had no business putting them in harm's way. The whole incident raises questions of maladministration. Winchester needs both commercial and residential development to be successfully undertaken, but it did not need another $1.2 million expended on a scheme rejected by the design jury, but which could not be changed and which wasn't financially viable without a subsidy. So I really do think Winchester deserves better.
And here's a letter from Rosemary Poole, who lives in St James's Villa here in Winchester. Sir, on a visit to the cathedral close last week, I was delighted to see that the Barbara Hepworth sculpture was no longer there. I remember many years ago when it first came here from Salisbury, many people wrote to the Dean to ask if it could be sent back, but to no avail. A beautiful close such as ours, with its lovely old houses, its mellow walls and mature trees, needs no further embellishment, and particular, not an ugly, in my opinion, metal structure, which I believe was meant to symbolise the crucifixion. By contrast, I do like the two pretty semi-detached villas at the bottom of Norman Road, the delightful new development where the old fire station used to be, and the attractive houses that front Winchester Village development. I sense the hand of my favourite local architect here, but whoever it is, I do congratulate them and thank them for adding to Winchester's built environment in this sensitive way.
And Paul Twelvetree's letter is on a familiar theme. Sir, having been instrumental in causing the long-awaited redevelopment of Silver Hill to be abandoned, it was an inspired decision for Councillor Kim Gottlieb to be appointed to the chairman of the Central Winchester Regeneration Committee, charged with bringing forward Silver Hill 2. Whilst he was very quick to express dissatisfaction with the former plans, he has been reluctant to set out his preferred vision. His appointment would have been an ideal opportunity for him to articulate that vision to Winchester residents, despite his earlier calls for the meetings to be held in private. However, it has been some weeks since that committee was created, and Councillor Gottlieb is yet to hold a single meeting. Regardless of whether or not you like the previous plans, we all agree that a development of the Silver Hill site needs to come forward quickly. So come on, Kim. Why the reluctance to get on with the job? Surely this is not a case of being able to talk the talk, but not being able to walk the walk. Winchester demands that people who claim to know what is best for this city, as Councillor Gottlieb does, should have the courage to put forth their alternative ideas. Those who are unable to do so shouldn't run for office. Surely Winchester deserves better. Paul Twelvetree, Burriton Road, Hestock.
Chris Seeley of Park Road writes about traffic absence. Sir, it's strange that in the illustrations of the proposed centre of Barton Farm, there is such a singular absence of traffic. Although large numbers of pedestrians are depicted there, there appears to be only one car travelling on the diverted Andover Road. The response from Calla at Barton Farm Forum to the question of road safety suggests that it is relying on the concept of shared space to manage the problem. This, together with the response from council officers that the Andover Road has the lowest levels of traffic of any of the arterial routes into Winchester, is not reassuring. Perhaps Calla would like to publish an amended illustration showing the likely flow of traffic at peak times, and given its wish to encourage movement of people on an east-west axis, the number and nature, if any, of crossing points on the main road.
Thank you. Now we move back in time to historical items. And we're going back 200 years, John.
Yes, a couple of pieces from August the 5th, 1816. First one's headed, Digger Entombed. On Tuesday afternoon, the funeral of Miss Burrows of Red Lion Street, Clerkenwell, came to St James's Church, Clerkenwell Green. The grave was ordered to be dug 20 feet, but when the body came to be lowered, the undertaker found some fault with the depth, and the gravedigger and his assistant went down to throw up a few more shovels of earth. Unfortunately, owing to the great pressure of the people, the shores gave way, and the earth fell in and buried them under it. Several men were immediately set about shovelling away the earth, and in about an hour, one of them, named Butcher, was taken out, and he's now recovered. The other man was dug out at about 10:30, but quite dead. And then, as if to prove there's nothing new under the sun, the second small piece here is headed Binge Drinking. On Thursday afternoon, a young man, a knife grinder, undertook for a wager to eat 3 quarts of peas, 3 pounds of fat bacon, 1/4 loaf of bread, and drink 2 quarts of porter and 1 pint of gin in the space of 1 hour at a public house in the town where he lived. He sat down to his meal at 11 o'clock in the forenoon and devoured the whole in 52 minutes with seeming ease.
And 100 years ago, August the 5th, 1916, there are two items. And the first, Zeppelin air raid. An attack by enemy aircraft on Monday night was reported from the eastern and southeastern counties. And it stated that bombs were dropped off the Thames estuary and that the raiders appeared to have spent some time cruising over the counties of Lincolnshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Cambridge, Essex, Kent and Huntingdon. The following communique was issued. Last night, between the hours of 10 p.m. and midnight, our eastern and southern counties were attacked by several hostile airships. The raiders flew at a great height. Owing to this fact and to patches of mist, the airships' movements gave rise to much uncertainty and their number was difficult to determine. And the second item, traitor hanged. Casement was hanged on Thursday morning. The government has issued a statement about his case. He had agreed with the German government that the brigade which he was trying to raise among Irish prisoners in Germany might be employed in Egypt against the British Crown. The prisoners who refused to join him were cruelly treated by the Germans. Some have since been exchanged as invalids and have died in this country, regarding Casement as their murderer.
There are two nuggets from 50 years ago. One is entitled Cathedral Dig. The excavation on the Cathedral Green is now in the intermediate stage between finishing the medieval levels and getting down to the Saxon. The most exciting discovery of the year has been a very fine piece of Saxon wall painting, a woman's head in earth colours on a white background, of the 9th century. Discarded from an earlier demolished building and built with other rubble into the new Minster's south wall. As its colours are very ephemeral, requests to see it are not at present welcome. Some of the floor of the old Minster, a plaster of broken Roman brick, is also becoming visible. The second is entitled Demolition Approved. Because of its potential danger to the public, Hampshire County Council, on the advice of Sir Dimmock White, chairman of the Castle Committee, decided at its Monday meeting at Winchester to approve the demolition of 79 High Street. Over 4 years ago, after consultation with Winchester City Council, the Minister of Housing and Local Government raised no objection to the building's eventual demolition, notwithstanding the fact that it was scheduled under the Town and Country Planning Act as a building of historic and architectural interest. Recently, the building, a timber frame structure faced with tiles and boards, has deteriorated. Slates have fallen from the roof, a part of one bow has collapsed, and a section of the balustrade is in a dangerous condition.
And 25 years ago, August the 2nd, 1991, there are two items. Incinerator to shut. The Otterbourne incinerator, which disposes of refuse from the Winchester and Eastleigh area, is set to close. It's due to be replaced by a waste plant in Portsmouth, costing up to £100 million. The refuse plant at Poles Lane, Otterbourne, is one of five in South Hampshire that will be replaced by the new Energy from Waste incinerator. The first steps were taken this week by members of Hampshire County Council's Policy and Resources Committee. They voted unanimously to pursue negotiations for a waste disposal contract with the Babcock Energy Limited Consortium. And the second item, MP appeals ban. The Winchester and Alton MP, John Brown, has lodged a form of appeal against what he called the grotesque injustice done to him in the members' interest debate last year. This was when Mr. Brown made a full apology to the House of Commons after the Select Committee report said he failed to disclose important business interests. He was suspended from the House for 20 days. The MP said he agreed fully with Ivan Lawrence QC MP, who, in the debate on March the 7th, 1990, described the Select Committee hearing as the worst type of kangaroo court, which perpetrated a catalogue of manifest injustices against him. And that concludes the historical items, and now we've got a Chronicle editorial comment, John.
Yes, here's a trenchant piece from the editor about something we heard about in the headlines. And it's headed, Closure and Eviction, the Right Thing to Do. Better late than never. Winchester City Council has at last taken action on a city centre house that's been the epicentre of antisocial behaviour for several years. As we reported on our front page, the house in Water Lane has been sealed off and no one can enter it for 3 months while the council takes eviction proceedings against the residents. Closure powers have been used in the past against crack houses, centres of drug dealing, but this is the first time that action's been taken under the 2014 Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act. It's the right thing to do, and the council should be prepared to do it again in the future, and again, and again. Across the district, there are far too many people's lives being blighted by the actions of others, selfish, often alcoholic people, who choose to ignore the obligations of living in a civilised society. Their oafish mantra of, I know my rights, should be balanced by the reasonable requests of decent people that they should not have to live next door to the noise, the litter, the abuse, the insults and the lurking fear of violence. Winchester is a generally tolerant place that accepts eccentricity, but there comes a point when the authorities' tolerance of people's lifestyles becomes not a sign of decency, but of willful neglect.
And now we're going to move on to first person.
And first person this week is headed Motorbikes. Time for a ban? The time when I most enjoyed riding a motorbike was after the silencer broke and my puny BSA Bantam became almost as loud as Concord. The slightest acceleration produced a staccato racket which echoed around as I sped past. The machine gun din thrilled me, and I enjoyed knowing that everyone in town was taking notice. I was only 16 at the time. Nearly 50 years later, and I drive a quiet family car. I wince when I look back on my selfish exhibitionism aboard a second-hand 175cc. The police should have stopped me. For weeks I must have been waking up shift workers and upsetting anyone trying to hold a conversation or hear their television. When I did fit a working silencer, it was because of pressure from Mum and Dad, and maybe a little because the noise was starting to get on the nerves of even me. Today, the police still seem unable to do much about loud bikes, so I wonder if they should be given more powers. I risk making myself unpopular with a section of the travelling public and with my next thought. So, if you know anyone with a motorbike, don't leave this issue of the Chronicle where they might find it. If no way is found to quieten them, how about a ban? It could be phased in. Anyone with a bike now could keep riding. The ban would be on issuing new motorcyclist licences. Trouble is, motorbikes do a lot of good. They open the road to the young, the poor, and people with nowhere to park a car. They emit less pollution than a car, and they ease congestion. They can weave through traffic jams, and some small boys even like the noise. But most of us are disturbed by the decibels. I certainly notice when one of those big touring bikes accelerates into our street. It's ba-ba-ba-ba-ba shaking the windows. Or when a peaceful stroll along ancient Kingsgate Street is interrupted by arriving bikes, sounding like a firework display. Quitting the EU will ensure we're free to make our own laws, Brexit campaign has told us. So now should be the perfect time to prepare a legal ban. It might even win Remain voters over to Brexit enthusiasm. A ban could be seen as world-leading legislation. Other tranquility-loving nations might copy us. A quieter Britain without motorbikes could be attractive to tourists, particularly with other traffic getting quieter as electric cars become the norm. Is a ban just wishful thinking? I'm not sure if Brexit will make a motorbike ban any more likely, because Brexit may not make Britain any more able to get its own way. Our need for free trade deals is the problem. Any country manufacturing motorbikes may hesitate to sign a deal with us if we won't accept their motorbike exports. Bikers have been a privileged group, free to wake the rest of us with a twist of their throttle control. They interrupt our lives and shatter our peace. Two other behavioural groups, dog owners and smokers, have modified their lifestyle in recent years, following clean-up campaigns and the smoking ban. So dog mess and cigarette smoke can generally be avoided these days. Next, it may be time to turn the volume down on motorbikes or even switch them off for good.
Well done. Now we're moving to Belgarum, Paul. Three items, I think.
Belgarum, an alternative look at the news. The first item has two little pictures, and it talks about Pokemon Go. That is a craze that's taking the world by storm. Pokemon Go is the new app that brings pocket monsters in the real world. It's on your smartphone. Trainers can use their smartphones to catch the little creatures and battle with other users. But to keep topped up, they need to visit Pokestops, dotted at significant locations around the city. One of these so-called stops is the plaque attached to the Chronicle building on Upper Brook Street. There's a little picture of the plaque. As a result, Belgarum has joined in the merriment, collecting 25 Pokemon, including the popular Pikachu. Pikachu is one of these little virtual reality people. And there is a picture of this small boy shown on the right-hand side of the article. Second article is entitled, Can Car Park Still Be Called Temporary? Just how long is a temporary car park a temporary car park? Hampshire County Council still offers the perk to its staff at Bar End next to the recycling centre. At a time when building land in Winchester is at a premium, Belgarum has always thought it would make a good site for social housing, nestling close to the River Itchen. We will get back soon with the council's response. The third item relates back to the armed robbery. Winchester's one-way system has often come in for criticism, but it may have prevented the armed robbers who carried out a terrifying raid on Justice Jewellery in Parchment Street, making a clean getaway that we heard about earlier. Winchester Crown Court heard how Domingo Nisita was the driver in the robbery in April. The 29-year-old from London originally had parked outside the shop, but moved the Peugeot van further down the road when asked by a member of the public. The bungling robber came unstuck when a dust cart blocked off his escape route from one end of the road and a police vehicle trapped him from the other. He was pictured being arrested outside Bell Fine Art, where he told officers, "I ain't done nothing." Nisita was jailed for 12 years. So when the next time traffic congestion brings vehicles to a halt in St George's Street or Friar's Gate, perhaps drivers should spare a thought for the fact that Winchester's narrow streets stopped three criminals from getting away with a haul worth £200,000.
Thank you. Now we've got the announcements, and we start with What's On. On Tuesday the 16th of August, 1 p.m. in Winchester Cathedral, there's a lunchtime concert with Claire Jones on the harp. On Saturday the 20th of August, at Badger Farm Community Centre, there's a horticultural autumn show. That's a bit early, 20th of August for autumn, isn't it? And that's between 2 and 4 p.m. And on Tuesday the 23rd of August, Winchester Cathedral lunchtime concert at 1 p.m. And that has Nicola Hands playing the oboe. Now, lighting up time ends on Friday the 5th of August at 5:37 a.m. and begins at 8:46 p.m. And on Wednesday the 10th of August, it ends at 5:45 a.m. and begins at 8:35 p.m. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370. And now we're going to continue with items of general news. John?
Yes, this is the season, isn't it, for summer shows, and the King's Somborne annual flower show once again exhibited. The headline is Event Blossoms Again in 91st Year. The very best of village life was celebrated at the King's Somborne Flower Show. The event, held last Saturday, attracted around 300 people who gathered at the village hall and the sports field. They enjoyed the flower show held in the hall, as well as a vintage car display and a dog championship on the recreation ground. The event, now in its 91st year, was a huge success, according to Secretary of the King's Somborne and District Horticultural Society, Pollyanne Monk. Mrs. Monk said, "I think it went very well. We were very lucky with the weather. It was not too hot, not too cold, and not raining." The flower show filled the hall beautifully, and there were a good number of entries in the vegetable and flower show classes too, and the judges were very impressed with what they saw. She said that the car display was a major talking point and that people also enjoyed the dog show. There was also a tea stall, a raffle, children's activities and the Lockerly Silver Band entertained throughout the day. Summing up the event, Mrs. Monk added, "The feedback's been very complimentary and people who attended it said there was a lovely village feel." And there's a very amusing picture directly beneath this article. Two entrants for the dog show. The dog on the left, his name is Hugo. I'm sorry, I'm not very good with dog breeds, but it's black and it's about the size of a small horse. And in its shadow is a beautiful little wire-haired dog called Doodle, who doesn't appear to be scared of Hugo at all.
Super Stoneman wins back-to-back podiums. Dean Stoneman strengthened his Indy Lights Championship hopes with two podium finishes in as many days, taking third and second place in Ohio. The Andretti driver from Bishop's Waltham is third in the overall standings, 25 points off the leader, after his double success. Stoneman had to work hard for his points in race one, having started from fourth on the grid, and a twisting track, which he had never raced on before. The 26-year-old took the chance to go around the outside of two cars to shift up to third, ahead of two of his championship rivals, including the leader. Stoneman was to come under pressure a couple of times as the race went on, but with the championship no doubt on his mind, the Southampton driver was in no mood to miss out on his sixth podium of the season. As the 30-lap race came to an end, rookie Stoneman finished just over a second behind the car ahead, and with it more valuable championship points. That was tough, one of the most physically demanding tracks I've raced at for a while, said Stoneman, before going one better the next day. Stoneman, who is racing in the IndyCar Feeder Series at tracks in the US for the first time, impressed again from the start with a steely display of ruthless overtaking to get himself up to third as early as the first lap. He made up for the disappointment of race two in Toronto when his car failed to start due to a still unknown fuel issue by keeping the second place car well within his sights. The pressure began to show on championship rival Felix Sorelle, who lost control, gifting second place to Stoneman, who said, "It was important for us to come here and get two good results. The level of competition is strong, so one mistake and you can pay dearly for it. We seem to lack a little bit of overall pace compared to the winner, which we need to look at. But all in all, I'm happy." And there is a photo of Dean Stoneman racing around the track, followed by very closely by another car.
As John said, this is the time of the year for parties, and the headline here is Perfect Party in Park for All Ages. Hundreds of people headed to Stanmore on Saturday for the Party in the Park. Scores of activities included a skate park jam run by Maverick Industries. The Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Jane Rutter, said the day was a great success and she enjoyed spending time at the various activities. She was on hand to open the new skate park that had been under construction since 2014 and said, "It was a fantastic day and an amazing event. I was delighted to be there. The skate jam was great to watch and everyone seemed to have a great time." Maverick, who built the new Stanmore site, gave away prizes to BMX riders and skateboarders. A DJ was also on hand to provide the music for those competing and spectating. Elsewhere at the event in Summer's Close, visitors were treated to a range of musical and dance performances, including Zumba, belly dancing, Nepalese dancers, a marching band and solo artists. The family-friendly event also featured a petting farm, fun fair, zorbering, children's go-karting, circus skills workshops and much more. Businesses, organisations, voluntary and community groups had stalls and Winchester Science Centre provided an inflatable planetarium. This year's instalment of the event, held since 2011, had a multicultural theme of music and dance. Portfolio holder for Environment, Health and Wellbeing at Winchester City Council, Frank Pearson, said, "The council is grateful to our sponsors for helping fund this fun-packed event." And there are four pictures surrounding the article. The first shows three very small boys in a police car. One of them is dressed up in a police helmet about six sizes too large for him. And that's Ty Webb, Alex Webb and Josh O'Connell. Then there's a picture of the mayor, Jane Rutter, in her full mayoral finery with a lot of children with bicycles and scooters at the skate jam. There's then a picture of Stuart Martin on the skateboard, and finally there's a picture of a Nepalese elder with a tambourine.
Yes, this is one of these headlines that's incomprehensible at first, but bear with me. Splash maps thrown out of Dragon's Den. A childless Ford entrepreneur received a roasting when he braved the BBC's Dragon's Den TV programme on Monday. The Fearsome Five didn't seem to grasp David Overton's concept of ordnance survey maps printed on fabric, which he called splash maps, as his pitch for a £60,000 investment in return for a 15% share of his business flopped. Sporting one of his maps as a natty cravat, David explained that his maps were ideal for hikers and mountain bikers, as they were far easier to manage in the great outdoors than the notoriously difficult-to-fold paper alternatives. They could also be worn as scarves, scrunched up in the pocket and tossed in the washing machine if they got dirty. To round off his presentation, Dave presented each of the five with a personalised splash map showing their home area. Peter Jones, who seemed not to have been listening, said, "What is this, a map or a scarf?" While Tuka Suleiman, the Cyprus-born businessman who made his fortune in the fashion retail trade, said David's target audience was very, very niche. David, a former innovation manager at the Ordnance Survey, had been pinning his hopes on support from Nick Jenkins, the founder of the online greetings card firm Moonpig, who admitted that he was a big fan of maps. It all looked to be going well, as Nick pronounced, "I love Ordnance Survey maps. I'm your target audience." But then he dashed David's hopes by claiming that if his idea was such a good one, the OS would have taken it up themselves. "The OS is 1,000 times more powerful than your brand," he told David. A disappointed David told the Chronicle that although he'd come away empty-handed on the day, he'd gained 10 minutes free publicity for his product on primetime national TV. And he added, "Going to the Dragon's Den gave me the discipline to have a look at the finances of the company and renewed confidence in my business plan." If David had been successful in securing the £60,000 investment he had planned on using part of the money on expanding into the US market. And there's a picture accompanying the article of a very smiling and still obviously confident and positive entrepreneur wearing one of the maps around his neck as a scarf while holding up another one for us to see.
Wannabe superstars show off their talents. From superb singers to mysterious magicians, Winchester's potential stars of the future took to the stage to take part in a Britain's Got Talent audition. The Railway Inn welcomed more than 20 acts who took part in Winchester's Got Talent on Monday. The acts are hoping to emulate the success of Diversity, Susan Boyle and Paul Potts. Many of those taking part were already regulars at the Railway Inn's Roots Night, which is the open mic night every Monday. The range of acts and talent was clear to see. One of them was Melissa Blakey, 21, from Sparkford Close, who sang the 2014 hit Riptide by Vance Joy. The University of Winchester student has been playing at the Railway for the past 6 months and was understandably nervous before the audition. Melissa said, "It is an absolute passion. I love playing and singing and being on stage. I watched Britain's Got Talent quite a lot when I was younger. I really enjoyed it. It is a really good show. Winchester is such a great city, but not many people know about its music scene." Also auditioning was Polly Berry of Polly and the Billet Doux. Another impressive act was Eddie George, 14, from Whitchurch, who describes himself as a folk mixed with hip-hop singer. The Testbourne Community School pupil impressed the audience when he sang Ed Sheeran's hit Give Me Love. Mixing things up was magician Alex Whitwell, 39, who performed card tricks. Another musician who wowed audiences was indie rocker Scott Freeman, 25, from St Giles Hill. Before playing, Scott said, "Tonight is about putting my name out there and getting more fans." By day, Eric Walker, 21, from Southampton, works as a data analyst, but by night, he is a ukulele player. He said, "I tend to play here every week at all the open mic event nights, and I am always performing at every chance I get. And there are two photographs of this. One is of Magic Alex mesmerising his audience with card tricks, and Polly Perry singing at the mic.
There is an old black and white photograph taken in August 1966, heading an article entitled Sir Francis's Yacht Sails to the Home Base. It was a grueling 30,000-mile voyage that earned him a unique place in maritime history. Half a century ago, Sir Francis Chichester set off from Hampshire in Gypsy Moth 4 and became the first person to sail single-handed round the globe. Now the yacht is returning to Buckler's Hard to mark the 50th anniversary of its epic journey. His son Giles is planning to give a talk as well as presenting the Villages Museum with a Royal Yacht Squadron flag that flew from Gypsy Moth throughout the voyage. Guests will include Bill Grindy, who was the local harbour master in 1966, and the new Lord Montague, who was only 5 at the time. Lord Montague said, "Sir Francis described the Beaulieu River as the most beautiful river I know, and had been a mooring holder since the 1950s. Before he set sail, local people played a vital role in his preparations, as well as providing support and waving him off on his long journey. One of those who helped Sir Francis Chichester gather the supplies he needed was Buckler's Hard shopkeeper, Rhoda Martin, whose tasks included preserving eggs by covering the shells with liquid paraffin and de-eyeing hundreds of potatoes to prevent them from sprouting. Her two sons, Chris and David, are returning to the village next week to help celebrate the anniversary. Sir Francis sailed from Buckler's Hard on August the 12th, 1966, for trials on the Solent before officially starting his voyage from Plymouth in August, on August the 27th. After 226 days at sea, stopping only in Sydney, Australia, the 65-year-old sailor and former aviator returned to Hampshire on September the 17th the following year, having travelled 29,630 miles. He was knighted with the sword used by Queen Elizabeth I to bestow the same honour on Sir Francis Drake. Gypsy Moth the 4th was later sold for £1 and a gin and tonic, Sir Francis's favourite tipple, to the UK Sailing Academy in Cowes. She also underwent a 400,000 refit at Camper & Nicholson, the Gosport company that built her. When Gypsy Moth 4 went on sale again, she was brought by business partners Eileen Skinner and Rob Thompson, whose aim was to inspire a new generation of sailors. The pair donated her to the Gypsy Moth Trust. Gypsy Moth is visiting Buckler's Hard on August the 12th and 13th and will be open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sir Francis's son, Giles Chichester, will give his talk at the Master Builders Hotel on August the 12th at 2:30. Visitors will be asked to make a small donation to the Gypsy Moth Trust.
Demolition plans for police station. A Winchester landmark is set to be demolished. The now empty police station in North Walls is likely to be knocked down should a planning application by the University of Southampton be approved. The station closed at the end of 2015 and staff were relocated to a new headquarters at Mottisfont Court in Tower Street. However, it's not clear what plans the university has for the building next to the School of Art in Park Avenue. The Chronicle understands that the existing building, dating back to the early 1960s, is not suitable for university use and that the university feels demolition is the best option. In a planning document, the plans are to remove asbestos materials and strip the surfaces before a demolition excavator will move in to finish off the job by knocking down the building. The document revealed that landscaping to the site will be enhanced and new fencing and gates will be installed. City Councillor Dominic Hiscock welcomed the move and said the building serves no purpose as it is and that the university has a good track record of development within the city. Councillor Hiscock said, "I'll be keeping a very close eye on this and I'll be very interested to see what plans the university has for the site. It makes sense for the university to acquire the site and use it properly if they have expansion plans so that they can retain their operation within the campus they have." But Ward Councillor Rose Burns says she has mixed feelings about the building being demolished. She called for university bosses to keep people informed of what they're planning to put on the site. Councillor Burns said, "We need to have chapter and verse about what they're planning. The university buildings already in Park Avenue are not in a good way, and if they're going to do anything at all, they need to do something with those buildings first." A spokesman for Southampton University said there was no further detail at the moment and no details on the site that they're able to give just yet. The police moved out of the station last November, with the area cars moving to the fire station on Eastern Lane and the neighbourhood policing team relocating to Mottisfont Court.
Pepper Pot inspiration could be Killer Gorilla. The legend of the Killer Gorilla, written by the 19th century explorer Paul du Chaillu, may be the inspiration for the Victorian novelty Silver Gorilla Pepper Pot in the Fine Silver and Objects of Virtue sale at Salisbury Sale Rooms, Woolley and Wallace in October. Attributed as the first white man to see, hunt and confirm the existence of gorillas, du Chaillu rose to fame in the 1860s when he returned from his expedition with stuffed gorillas he had hunted, making them accessible for the rest of the world to view. His book Explorations and Adventures of Equatorial Africa was published in 1861 and featured stories of his remarkable expedition, which lasted 3.5 years from 1856. One story from the book was of a hunting expedition and a killer gorilla. Du Chaillu was out with a group of natives. They split in different directions, and after a while, he heard the tremendous roar of the gorilla. Instinctively, we made for the spot. The poor brave fellow who'd gone off alone was lying on the ground in a pool of his own blood. Beside him lay his gun, the stock broken and the barrel bent almost double. In one place it was flattened and it bore plainly the marks of the gorilla's teeth. This huge gorilla thought the gun was his enemy, so he had seized it and dashed it on the ground. Not satisfied, had it taken it up again and given it a tremendous bite. Du Chaillu was savaged by other experts, scientists and explorers who debased many of his stories as exaggerations, but he maintained they were true and his book was a huge success. The stories were likened to a prequel to Gerald Durrell's My Family and Other Animals. The Killer Gorilla, offered on October the 26th, is by Thomas William Henry and Louis D., dated London, 1861, and estimated at £1,500 to £2,000. Other novelty items from the private collection include kittens, pigs, frogs, and a cockatoo whiskey tot by Alexander Crichton, dated London, 1881. For more information or to consign items to the auction, please contact Lucy Chalmers on 01722 424 594, and there are two photos. One of the gorilla, the very unfortunate, a model of the very unfortunate gorilla, and of a parrot. I think looks like a parrot.
The future of an ex-offender's hostel in Winchester appears to be uncertain. Elaine House on Hyde Street has been boarded up after the last resident departed. the doors and ground floor windows of the three-storey Georgian house have been protected by sheets of metal shuttering. The hostel was operated by Stonham Housing Association, which was asked to clarify the building's future, but had not responded at the time of going to press. The local city councillor, Dominic Hiscock, said he understood the problem to be funding. It's been sealed about a week, but it has been closing down for a while because of funding issues and the people were being rehoused. It's a shame because it fulfilled a role as somewhere for ex-offenders to live. Councillor Hiscock said they have had difficult people there, but it was staffed 24/7, so there was no problem. Once it started to be run down, it did become a problem. Some neighbours are relieved now it's been shuttered up. People have asked me, what is the future of it? But I don't know. The operators work closely with the probation service. The hostel was set up in the 1990s after a donation by Sir John Allen, who had been the vicar of Week and was a campaigner on social issues, including the homeless, helping to set up the Trinity Centre in the 1980s and the action group on asylum seekers when they were being held in Winchester Prison at the turn of the millennium. An issue will be the terms of the bequest and the uses to which the building can be put. An 18th or 19th century building in Hyde would normally be expected to reach a high six-figure sum if sold for housing.
Yes, plenty to be proud about with our local schools, and here's another example of that in an article headed West End Spectacle. It was the West End production which saw students at an Alresford school excel. For the past 9 months, pupils at Perrin School have worked non-stop to stage the Phantom of the Opera. The ambitious project was made up of 120 Perrin students forming the cast, orchestra and backstage team. The pupils were spurred on when they received a personal note from Andrew Lloyd Webber wishing them luck. And the cast of the West End musical also made a good luck video courtesy of ex-Perrin student Daisy Hulbert, who plays the leading role. The main hall of the school was transformed into an incredible set, where the audiences stepped back in time into the opera house of the Paris Opera Populaire. Stage production company M3 Technology worked tirelessly to build the set, which has all the special effects inspired from the West End production, including a flying chandelier and a motorised boat. They're also responsible for all technical aspects of the production, including the lighting, the sound and the pyrotechnics. Director of the school's creative arts department, Maralitza Alexiou, said, "I've been astounded by the maturity and dedication demonstrated by these pupils, both through their talents and their extraordinary sense of creative ambition. They've shown a great sense of responsibility both to one another and also to the staff working with them." The school's head teacher, Steve Jones, said, "I can honestly say that this performance not only surpasses any school performance I have ever seen, but genuinely rivals many professional productions. I'm incredibly proud of my students and staff for their hard work, dedication and talent shown throughout the process." The production, in July, was hailed as a huge success and received massive positive feedback. Writer and director of musicals for kids, John Gleedale, saw the production and he said, "Congratulations to all involved. In more than 40 years' involvement with school and youth theatre productions, I've never seen such an ambitious musical production in a school. How brilliant to have a performing arts team who are dedicated enough to mount such a production and leadership team, who must be bursting with pride, who can see the value of such a venture. I applaud you." And that article is accompanied by a number of really rather wonderful photographs showing some clearly very talented and committed young people in their costume performing the musical.
A view from above as 41-metre-tall crane installed to play a key role in the building of a new £15 million housing scheme for elderly residents. A part of Winchester as you have never seen it before, a 41-metre-tall crane has been installed to play a key role in building a £15 million scheme of housing for the elderly. It gives towering views across the city, including Chesil Street. The crane will be in place for 40 weeks to help build the 52-home extra care housing on the former Chesil Street surface car park. City councillors visited the site on Friday to meet contractors Galliford Try. Councillor Caroline Horrell, portfolio holder for housing, said, "It was fascinating to hear about the thorough safety measures that are in place for the crane. There is a 24-point checklist before the start of each shift and an 8-point check at the end of each shift, plus an 11-point weekly checklist. Hampshire County Council has put in place a highways licence. The crane also has an appointed person, a lift supervisor, a slinger banksman, and driver to coordinate each lift and task relating to each material and plant lift. The tower crane will be working each day. At the end of each shift, the crane will be put into free slew. This is similar to a weather vane and allows the crane to move in the wind while the site is closed or the driver is on brakes. There are additional measures in place to warn against and stop travel of the crane past a fixed point, and pedestrian and traffic control measures are in place when unloading from the curbside. Lifting stops in strong winds or if electrical storms are forecast. Meanwhile, another crane is in place at Victoria Court for a second city council housing scheme. This crane is a Spanish Jazzo 80. It is 19.7 metres high with a 30.5 metre jib and can lift up to 5 tonnes. The crane is lifting the heavy steel into place for the reinforced concrete works. Well, that was a very technical article. And there is a photo, an aerial view of the site in Chesil Street from the top of this very tall crane.
Another slightly technical article. The University of Southampton showcased its world-leading aerospace research and expertise at the Farnborough International Air Show. The university's unmanned air vehicle was included in the air displays and beamed live photography onto TV screens across the exhibition halls. Based on the innovation zone, the university focused on three main themes: autonomy, sensors, and cybersecurity. Other technology demonstrated throughout the week included optical sensors for fuel level monitoring, structural sensing kit to detect and analyse movement in wings, for example, and remote sensing diagnostic experiments with Boeing. During the week of the show, the university announced it was to sign strategic agreement with BAE Systems to strengthen the long-term relationship in research, education and consultancy. Southampton will be one of the first of a few selected universities in the UK to sign such an agreement after BAE Systems announced that in future it will focus on building partnerships with a smaller number of universities. Professor Mark Spearing, University Pro Vice Chancellor, said, "We highly value the relationship with a world-class company and look forward to strengthening our relationship." And it showed a picture of the unmanned air vehicle, which looks like a very large model aircraft with a wingspan of about 9 feet and 2 engines.
I'm delighted to say this next piece isn't technical at all, although it does have some quite long words. It's headed £500,000 for Cathedral. Winchester Cathedral has been given a major boost to mark the centenary of the First World War. The cathedral will receive £500,000 for the repair and conversion of windows. This money comes from part of a £14.5 million fund which cathedrals across the UK are receiving to mark the centenary of the war and to repair these powerful symbols of British history, the government has said. The fund was launched in 2014 and is designed to help preserve cathedrals for future generations. Announcing the latest round of funding, Culture Secretary Karen Bradley said, "Cathedrals are powerful symbols of Britain's shared history. They're important not only for their architecture and heritage, but also for the vital role they continue to play in communities. I'm delighted, therefore, that the First World War Centenary Cathedral Repairs Fund will ensure that these cathedrals remain in a good state of repair and are preserved for future generations." Dame Fiona Reynolds, chairwoman of the Cathedrals Fabric Commission for England, said, "Cathedrals which benefited from the first phase of this fund have been repaired and refurbished, and staff and volunteers now have time and resources to serve their cities and regions with renewed energy."
Revised plan to build new green mill. Sparshot College has submitted a revised planning application for its green gas mill. This comes after the City Council Planning Committee rebuffed original proposals in April because contracts were not signed, restricting road use for fuel delivery drivers. There have been more than 200 objections. Now, the college says, it has addressed the traffic concerns with new detailed studies, route planning and driver controls. Tim Jackson, principal, said, "There has been considerable work undertaken to address the main points of concern." He added, "The benefits of the green gas mill and renewable energy training centre are massive, from helping Winchester District towards its renewable energy targets to training the next generation of green gas professionals in a growing industry, through to the financial benefits this project provides to the local farming community and rural economy." The college claims the dubbed green gas mill, which turns grass into gas, can produce power for nearly 5,000 homes a year. The anaerobic digester would need 60,000 tonnes of fuel per year to run. Up to 8 specialist jobs will be created to run the mill, while the new supply contracts with farmers providing the grass and rye feedstock required to supply the anaerobic digestion process will also reinforce existing jobs. Furthermore, a community benefit fund of £5,000 a year would be available to the community. Critics, including Mitchell Delver farmer Douglas Patterson, are not convinced the mill would be sustainable. But he said farmers will still consider offers as the industry is in a terrible state at the moment. He added, "It would be very hard for some farmers to reject the contract because of principles." And there is a photo of a smiling face of the college principal smiling out of the article.
The Winchester department store Beals is to remain open until August the 13th. The Beals chain originally announced in April that it would close its store in the Brooks Shopping Centre on Monday. A sale is underway in the now largely empty store. Beals, which has 29 stores across the country, was bought last year for just $1.2 million by investor Andrew Perloff. It made pre-tax losses of $4.6 million in the year ending November 2014. New chairman Stuart Lyons has led a Back to Beals campaign to encourage customers to return, but the company said it needed to cut rents on 14 sites which were dragging the group down.
Speeding fine for Saints star Classy. Saints midfielder Jordy Classy, who lives near Winchester, has been fined for speeding. Classy's 14-reg Land Rover was caught by a fixed-speed camera breaking the 30-mile-an-hour limit that's in place on the St Mary's Place and Kingsway stretch of road in Southampton on February the 13th, Aldershot magistrates were told. The prosecution proved the case in Classy's absence, as he was not in court for the hearing. The bench fined him £220 and added a £22 victim surcharge, along with ordering the player to pay £85 costs. Classy, aged 25, of South Down Road in Shawford, also had his licence endorsed with 3 penalty points. The combative Dutch midfielder was signed by Ronald Koeman last summer from Feyenoord for around £8 to £10 million as a replacement for Manchester United-bound Morgan Schneiderlin. His first season at St Mary's was blighted by a series of injuries, including one picked up in his very first game. He made 15 appearances and has yet to score a goal in the Premier League. He's played 11 times for the Netherlands, including at the 2014 World Cup.
Students behind bars. Peter Simmons College students recently found out about life behind bars. Upper Sixth Law, Sociology and Psychology students attended a Behind Bars conference organised by True Life Conferences at the college, where they were introduced to former prison inmates and a forensic psychologist. Each speaker talked about their experiences in prison and within the justice system. They all gave frank accounts, presenting students with the reality of what life is like, while leaving students to ponder questions about prison reform and how to deal with serious or repeat offenders. The event was part funded by the Simondians Association as part of their programme to broaden the experience of students and challenge them to think differently about education and opportunity. Law teacher Graham Child said, "Thanks to the Simondians Association, we were able to provide this fantastic opportunity for our students to find out about what life is like behind bars to help them with their studies."
Work on revamping the area outside the Casson block in Winchester city centre is due to start on Monday. The work to widen the terrace area and create more seating for the nearby restaurants on St George's Street is expected to take about 10 weeks. It will also include installing a new handrail for the ramp, repaving and new lighting. There will also be planters both at the edge of the terraced area along St George Street and surrounding the existing pillars to protect people from traffic pollution. Local traders such as Tom Rometer at Tom's Deli and Mif Khayyam at the Bengal Sage campaign have campaigned for the area to be better used.
And more to celebrate from our young people. King's Pupils Top Engineers. Young engineers from a Winchester school have triumphed in a national engineering challenge. Students from King's School won the Institution of Engineering and Technology, IET, National Faraday Engineering Challenge. The school was one of five to reach the national final in Milton Keynes and also won £1,000. More than 120 events took place across the country to host the IET Faraday Challenge Days. Up to six teams of local school students competed at each event to find the best solution to an engineering-related challenge. These were all based on the BBC's micro-bit innovation, a small, programmable tool designed to introduce those in Year 7 to the world of coding, and can be used to create anything from games and animations to apps and scrolling stories. The winning team from King's was made up of two girls and four boys. Student Lily Smith said, "It was amazing just making it through to the final at Bletchley Park. All the teams had worked so hard to be there, and winning was fantastic." A total of 4,572 students took part in the events across the UK. And Gareth James, who is the IET Head of Education, said, "This year's Faraday season has been the largest ever. The quality of the students' work throughout has been fantastic, and it was an extremely close final. I'd like to congratulate King's School on their win."
Spaces to be added at station. Southwest Trains is set to boost car parking at Winchester Station with work to start next month. The company is adding a second deck to the car park off Stockbridge Road, with construction due to finish by the end of the year. The company used permitted development rights and did not require a full planning application to the City Council to add the 60 spaces. During construction, 200 spaces in the car park will be closed. The current decked car park, accessed off Andover Road, will remain open during the works. Alistair Wright, SWT, head of station property, said, "Winchester Station was used for nearly 5 million journeys in 2014-15. This project will provide approximately 60 extra spaces and is part of our multi-million pound programme to provide 1,400 extra spaces across the network."
Thank you. That concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Angela Ling, Carol Fraser and Jane Thomas. And thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And of course, thanks to our readers, John Regan.
Cheerio.
Maria Head.
Bye.
And Paul Maxlow Thompson.
Bye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye and do have an enjoyable week. When you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.